All right, so tonight we are continuing with our class on the Genjo Koan. And I need to pull up the the shared Google document, that is so I can share my screen. But just the gist of it is, we're studying the Genjo Koan is a short text by Zen Master Dogen. He lived in the 1200s. And this is the 10th class we're doing on it. And there's going to be a few more. We're not done with it yet. And recordings of the previous classes are available on the Bright Way Zen website, if you look under resources. And I've also done podcast episodes on it and stuff. Tonight, we are studying the part of the text which comes after the part about ash and firewood. So I'm going to share my screen. I'm also going to put a link to a PDF in the chat. So if you are on a computer, you can pull that up. And in the Zendo here, I've always been making too many copies, so now I only made seven, but you know, y'all can share. But there is seven, so it should go pretty far. And let me just pull up my document. Okay. All right, so how should I start this? This, before we even get into this paragraph itself, we kind of need to talk about enlightenment, because this whole paragraph is about enlightenment. And I feel like this, the question that Dogen is addressing in this paragraph, in this little story and metaphor that he talks about, is essentially how is a limited ordinary being capable of something as profound as realization? Or what does an awakening mean to a person's humanity? So in the text, as you will see, Satori is mentioned quite a number of times, and that is generally translated as enlightenment, awakening, comprehension, understanding. So in Zen, of course, we're talking particularly, what is it that we understand? What is it we comprehend? The most important aspect of this is that we comprehend our true self nature. And that is that, contrary to the sense of ourselves that we have developed from the time we were born, we are empty of any enduring, independent, inherent essence. And or another way to put this is our sense of what I like to call the executive I. You know, as we move about our lives, there's a sense that I am me. I am going about my day. I am making my decisions. I am experiencing this. I am noticing this. There's an I in there. There's an I who is generally in charge of our lives, or even if there's some aspects of our habits or mind or body that we can't quite control, we have a plan for that. We have an agenda, we have an intention. Sometimes it just doesn't, we can't make it all happen the way we would like, but there's still that sense of executive I. So the truth is that sense of I is a complete illusion. That I It's in a sense you want to say it. It's not that it doesn't exist the way we think it does, right? It exists as a phenomenon, as a mental phenomenon. It exists as a sense, same way as if you wake up from a dream, somebody doesn't say that dream wasn't real. I mean, it was in a sense. You did have that dream, but it was just a dream. It's not reality. So in the same sense, our sense of executive I is as a dream. And waking up to that, really, really perceiving that for ourselves is part of awakening, enlightenment. In the Zen school, it's understood that enlightenment, awakening, it's not a one-time, all-or-nothing thing. Even if it's very dramatic, even if sometimes people have dramatic experiences of a big perspective shift, but then there's integration that needs to happen, there's deepening, there's other insights. It's not an all or nothing thing. But it is recognized in particular that this awakening to the true nature of self is extremely important and pivotal. So that's like a big, big important shift. And as we recognize that executive I, like we dreamt it up, what we also sense is that our self is, and there's many ways to describe this, right? It's like painting a sunset. You know, how are we going to describe it today? We have a sense that our self is boundless, that it doesn't have boundaries. It's not, in a sense, everything that I encounter is myself, is part of myself. There's a sense of not to, of not being separate from. It becomes very clear that reality exists. We're not making it up. But most of what we cling to in our minds are simply creations of our own mind. The discriminations, the names, the judgments are, you know, they're a layer, they're a gloss that we put on reality, and they don't have, they're not inherently real. We sense that our existence, just as it is, free of any expectations of how it should be, is actually luminous and miraculous. And we get a sense of comfort with a sense that our self exists, but it just doesn't, you just can't grasp it. You can't pin it down. It has no, you know, enduring essence inside. We exist, as I've said before, it's kind of like, we're more like a forest. You know, a forest exists, but really, like, where is the boundary of the forest? That's kind of arbitrary. You can't go and like, oh, well, there's the forest, that tree or that rock, or, you know, what is the forest? You can't grasp what the forest is, but the forest is real. It's a lovely thing. So we wake up to the fact that this is the nature of ourselves, and by extension, we recognize it's the nature of all things. So this enlightenment can be gradual or sudden. It's like we can get wet by walking in a mist, or we can get wet by jumping into a lake. There's different ways, but one of my teachers, Kjogen Carlson, in this book, You Are Still Here, he has a chapter on Kensho. Kensho meaning awakening to the nature of self. So it's another word that tends to be used for awakening or enlightenment. Although it's understood to be just that first awakening to the nature of self. And it, you know, that's just the first step in opening up to wisdom. But Kyogen says that whether we wake up to this slowly or we make a big splash, the understanding is the same. waking up to the same wisdom, the same reality. And slow or sudden, it is a dramatic shift in perspective. So there may be, if you have a dramatic experience, you may be able to point to October 12th, but most of us, it's just like Kyogen says, it's like a flower gradually opening, you know, it's just a little opening here, an insight there. Ah. And then over time, we just begin to get familiar with this understanding. Before we understand, it's like we're living in a dream and we think it's real. After we understand, we are free from the most painful delusions. This is what the Heart Sutra is talking about. Prajna Paramita is the perfection of wisdom. That's this wisdom of emptiness and suchness that we hope to wake up to. And the Heart Sutra says, Bodhisattva relies on Prajna Paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. So there is a before and after in terms of waking up in this respect, and yet before and after are tricky, if not impossible, to delineate. Awakening is something that in Soto Zen in particular, and in this lineage, we don't talk about a lot. I mean, it's always kind of back there and referred to and stuff, but we don't talk about it really explicitly, putting it front and center a lot, as opposed to certain schools, particularly of Rinzai Zen. You know, this is the point. Nothing else is really worth talking about. If you don't get this, so I can emphasize this a great deal. So the awakening, enlightenment, whatever, is a koan in the sense that it's not, that it presents a bit of a tension, a bit of an obstacle in and of itself. What is this thing? It's not helpful to grasp after awakening. Like once we kind of concretize it too much, and then we're like, have you awakened? Have I awakened? When did you awaken? How awakened are you? I hope that I can get awakened if I try this really hard. Like, ooh, that's, you know, it's a recipe for crazy making. But on the other hand, it's not helpful to just forget about it. So if anything, Zen, Soto Zen may err on the side of it being like, oh yeah, you know, it's all just like, you know, just be happy in your everyday life and try to be a nice person. We kind of, you know, we de-emphasize it a little bit. So one of the biggest impediments to awakening is our delusion about what it means. So, you know, if we've never conceived of it before, we don't care about it, whatever, that's no big deal. But once we're, okay, you know, we're part of a tradition where they mention it, kind of curious or whatever, naturally we have ideas about what this must mean or might mean or whatever. So earlier in the Genjo Koan, Dogen says, Buddha's greatly enlightened delusion. Living beings become greatly deluded about enlightenment. So that's my own little translation there, trying to go really as literally as possible according to the characters and words that Dogen used. So Buddha's greatly enlightened delusion, living beings become greatly deluded about enlightenment. So while we work on awakening to our true nature through, you know, study and zazen and meditation retreats and daily mindfulness and precept work, It can also be helpful to wrestle with the concept of enlightenment in order to enlighten our delusions about it. And that's what Dogen is doing in this paragraph. So let me share my screen. Oh, first, before I do that, let me get the PDF, the link to the PDF, in case anybody prefers that. And I think, you know, once I share my screen, I think you can, you know, opt out of seeing that if you would prefer to have your screen dominated by the by your PDF. And then share. Okay. And make my a Zoom screen a little bigger so I can see more people. All right. So this is a long passage tonight, so I won't go over every word. I've heard from a few people that, you know, wrangling at length over the kanji, the Japanese, is not all that interesting to you. So this is here if you enjoy that, or if you want to kind of like, even though this took me quite a while to piece this document together, I wanted to do it just for my own sake. I wanted to just stew in Dogen's words, and but I did do a translation. Obviously, you know, I'm informed by the other English translations, but, and I'm dependent on others for the translation of each character and word. But my translation, I like to think, is just very, very simple with an absolute minimum of interpretation. And I really love how it brings out some aspects of the Japanese, which can get covered over by English. So, a person attaining enlightenment is like the moon dwelling in water. So this is usually translated as the moon's reflection in water. And it may very well be that in Japanese, if you say the moon dwells in water, that it means it's reflected. I don't know. Could be. But the word is dwell or stay. And I really actually kind of like that image of like somehow the moon is in the water. You know, when it's the moon is shining down and there's a drop of water or something, the moon is in a sense there. So a person attaining enlightenment is like the moon dwelling in water. The moon, Tsuki is the moon, Mizu is water. The moon doesn't get wet. The water doesn't break. Although the light is broad and great, it dwells in a small amount of water. So inches of water is just, it means a very small amount. So the moon's light, this hole in the sky is great, but it is able to dwell in a small amount of water. The entire moon and the whole sky also dwell in a dewdrop on a blade of grass and in a single drop of water. Like a grass's dewdrop and one drop's water. So similarly, the entire moon and the whole sky can be reflected in this little drop of water. So enlightenment not breaking the person is like the moon not piercing the water. So I really liked how one translation that I worked with said, so it goes, Satori no hito o yaburazaru koto. And the koto makes a gerund of doesn't break. So it becomes, you know, not breaking, becomes a noun. So enlightenment, not breaking the person, is like the moon not piercing the water. A person's not impeding enlightenment, again, that made into a gerund, is like the dewdrop not impeding the sky's moon. The height of the moon should be the depth of the dewdrop. So I love that, that image of, you know, however large the moon is, it fits in the dewdrop. As for times, length or brevity. So they have several, the Japanese has several compound characters here. So length, brevity, cho tan, and dai sui, big water, sho sui, small water. So as for length, times, length or brevity, you should investigate big water and small water and the width or narrowness of the sky's moon. So this is very poetic. And if anybody wants to see, I realize that as I'm sharing screen, you can't see it all. So if you want to pull up the PDF, you have control. So Dogen's teaching in this, to me, it suggests that it's common for us to think that a person is broken by enlightenment or constrains enlightenment or can't, like somehow that the person has to, you know, explode or pop or change beyond recognition in order to manifest or contain enlightenment. So the person is, of course, the collection of all the things we identify as self or belonging to self, our body, our perceptions, thoughts, feelings, opinions, intentions, understanding, etc. So what might it mean for a person to be broken by enlightenment? So yabureru means break, destroy, rip, or tear. It's not as if enlightenment can't be contained within the small container of this person. So this person kind of tears or, you know, is broken open. What would it mean for enlightenment to destroy the person? And seeing as this is one of the delusions which Dogen is suggesting that we are fond of, I thought I would, that we could do a shared brainstorm on this. What would it mean? I mean, he's saying enlightenment doesn't destroy the person, right? But if he's saying that, that seems to suggest that we, you know, we might have that idea. So what, if we have that idea, what are we thinking enlightenment does to somebody in the sense that it might destroy or break the person? So anyone, yeah, John.
When, what does it really mean to give up the ego, right? The self. So when one contemplates enlightenment, what this small self that I know of is and perceive as me, you know, what happens to it? is it lost? And what does that mean? And I think the statement basically says that it's not lost. I kind of think it's transitioned. You realize you're part of a larger thing. Your concept that you were a separate self goes away, but you're not lost. You're not gone.
Dave.
I feel as if I'm a flawed person, and I'm almost composed of my flaws, and if my flaws were all purged, that would be it for me. There wouldn't be anything left of me.
Yeah.
Kind of build on what Dave said, I think when I picture somebody who's enlightened, I think, they'll be perfect and things won't bother them and they won't have like feelings to wrestle with, you know, because they'll be very serene. And it's true that that wouldn't be me anymore.
I feel like maybe enlightenment would be so overwhelming that, like, if we truly attained it, we couldn't handle it.
Similarly, I was thinking about it. Blow your mind. It's similar.
Sylvia.
I don't think enlightenment can break, destroy the person. So it would be delusion to think that, in my opinion. I think death does that. I don't think enlightenment breaks the person, obliterates it completely. It's why we continue to practice, because the way I read the little Dogen I read, there's no difference between practice and enlightenment. So
yeah, but you're jumping ahead, Sylvie. We're trying to explore the delusion. Yeah, like we kind of know this isn't so, and yet before we really know what this might feel like or look like, you know, what we have ideas, inevitably.
Yes, to rephrase that, destroys the story we tell ourselves about being in identifying with a particular train of thought. So it is the story we tell in our heads.
Mm-hmm. The narrative which to some extent we use to survive. Charles.
I didn't really have anything new to say, but I thought the second one was really well said, and that's exactly how I felt.
I really thought myself that if I really let go, you know, in meditation, if I really gave up that attachment to self and, you know, went deep into this, that like I really thought that would just be like a vegetable or something. Like I would lose my ability to function. You know, my ability to make judgments and make sense of the world and whatever, if I let that go, I'd just, how would you live? Yeah.
I will say one time, like in college, when I was just really reading a ton of like Buddhist books, I went and like hung out with my brother for the first time in a while. And he must have like smoked a bunch of weed because he thought that I was like broken and like this whole different person that was like super zenned out, and that his brother was like gone. And so that's kind of what I think about. But then like, I don't know, it kind of wears off after you like, you know,
yeah,
read those books, and then kind of it fades away. But
I think I also had a sense that I wouldn't care anymore, and this reflects something, you know, what somebody also said, you know, like having feelings to wrestle with, but in another sense, like our feelings, our affection, our passion, our sense of right and wrong, like these are, we're very, very identified with these things. Like, what are we essentially if we're not those things? Yeah. So that's the gist, I think, of this sense of what we think enlightened might do to the person, to the mundane person. And then we have this lovely metaphor of the moon reflected in a dewdrop. So what is this saying about our practice then? You know, Dogen doesn't just stop at saying like, oh, that's a delusion, that enlightenment won't break the person. But he's, you know, compassionately giving us some images to try to imagine what this might look like. He says our personhood does not obstruct, impede, or hinder enlightenment, which can seem pretty far-fetched. Like, come on, like this person has got to hinder enlightenment. This person certainly can't help, you know, like this has got to be in the way, right? All of these, this attachment to self and this delusion and all of the stuff and the strong sense of myself, this has got to somehow, we need to purify that, we need to let it go, we need to transcend it, we need to somehow, that needs to be cleaned up before we can awaken. But he's saying that's not so. That the drop of water that the person is not constrain it. It can completely contain this enlightenment. Even though we're just small and limited people. And also that this enlightenment is not something achieved or owned by us. It's just our nature to reflect it. It's just, you know, the moon dwells in the water, but it's not, yeah, it's not something we achieve. The dewdrop doesn't, you know, struggle mightily in order to become one with the moon. So I think, was thinking of small groups, but I think that might just take too much time. So I'm hoping that we can just open it up and have a discussion, and that you will You will jump in with some thoughts as if you were in a small group. I know it's a little more daunting, but what I wanted to ask the small groups was, first of all, how do you relate to the idea of enlightenment? I'm very curious. I wish I could do just like a, you know, somehow see into every one of your minds and, you know, get a snapshot of what you think about enlightenment. I'm imagining there's a whole range from curious, skeptical, feel it's kind of irrelevant. Maybe there's, you know, there's lots of parts of Buddhism and Zen that seem interesting to you. Enlightenment's like, well, I won't worry about that now. Maybe it's just confusing. Maybe you're intrigued, fascinated, annoyed, bored, dismissive. That I don't know. I suspect that there's quite a few of us who just kind of think it doesn't apply to us. That's something for like the spiritual athletes or the monks or those, like, you know. Or you might be like I was and just be like completely fascinated and determined from the get-go that I was going to achieve this for myself. One way or another, damn it, I was going to wake up. And that took a long time. That really, like, because like I said, if you do start to like engage it and kind of want it or move toward it or something, then you're setting up a duality and then you don't have it and then it's frustrating and then da-da-da-da. But I don't know that there's any way around that. John.
So I think of it as you know, transcending certain things, you know, we from time to time we'll have a conflict in our rational thought. We say, you know, this is a problem, you look at it from different ways. But at some point you have like an aha moment and you come up with a solution that transcends the problem. And when you transcend that problem, you still see the points that you had, but you have a higher level understanding that you've transcended it. And those problems are only problems when you forget about what you've transcended and go back to the individual problems. And so you have a conflict in this rational, relational world, but everybody's probably had these little transcending experiences. And to me, enlightenment is the complete transcendence of all your problems, of all your misconceptions. And you can see little transcending things. You can understand that there's little tiny levels that are seem like enlightenment. But to me, full enlightenment is the entire thing.
And how do you feel about it? Like, that's your kind of concept of enlightenment. But do you like? You want to achieve it? You like think that'll happen next lifetime?
There's part of me that wants to achieve it. There's part of me that thinks it's possible. It's my attachment to things that it's pretty clear that, you know, I mean, I'll leave here and I'll go, you know, play with, you know, my kids or do whatever, right? I mean, it's like, do I want to give up all this stuff? I have a really good life, right? And what does it mean to transcend it? And it goes back to the question we just asked. It's like, are you lost or whatever? And there's also a lot of work to do it. Although in theory it's a piece of cake, right? I can transcend like that. So I don't know. As I get older, I'm realizing that I guess at the end of my bucket list is enlightenment. So, but it's like the last thing on my bucket list. Because there's a lot of other things I want to experience. And it's like, well, I don't think they're quite the same if I'm enlightened. But
thank you. Dave.
Move up to the chair this time. So, I mean, it might just be my sunny disposition, but I don't think about it very much. In fact, my first reaction is I believe in it in the same way that I believe in hungry ghosts or any of the other metaphors we banter about. And if anybody were to tell me with a straight face that they were an enlightened person, I'd automatically assume they were full of shit. You know, I don't know. So it's not something I concern myself with very much, to the point where I'm not quite sure that I even believe in it fully. But there.
Thank you for your honesty. Mark.
I guess my reaction is, even if you were to accept that the water reflects the moon naturally, that it can't help but reflect the moon, that it never had any choice but to reflect the moon, there is a certain amount of disappointment that the moon doesn't punch a hole in the water.
Yeah, it's true. On the one hand, we're glad that the person isn't broken, but on the other hand, it's like, what? Yeah, the person isn't broken? I feel ambivalent about that for sure. Yeah, like, you know, if you go, I never had a big, you know, one-time deal that was certified as a Kensho, but, you know, obviously I added up enough little insights, whatever, that my teacher empowered me as a teacher. And, you know, it's very easy. I'm sure I'm not the only one. It's very common. If you do stick with Zen long enough and you do jump through all the hoops and you do all the stuff and, you know, potentially you receive Dharma transmission and you're empowered as a teacher, lay or ordained, you know, there's a great disillusion about what that actually means, right? Like, kind of like Mark was saying, it's like, I thought if this happened, that would be like, I'd be fixed, you know, that I'd be good. I wouldn't have any more struggles. I'd understand this. I'd understand, you know, like the assumptions. And it's like, really? Huh. But of course, yeah, that's just the small-minded aspect of it. So whatever your attitude toward enlightenment, what is this suggestion that as a person you could reflect enlightenment like a dewdrop reflects the moon in the sky? That it doesn't require, doesn't involve the destruction of the person. Now, definitely we know from experience, and what is very good is that over time, practice definitely can, I don't know, I hesitate to say improve the person, but you know, I mean, it can make us, you know, less stressed and more compassionate and, you know, more moral and honest and authentic. And there's all kinds of benefits of practice to the person. But that's not what we're talking about in this section. So much of the Genjo Koan, the rest of the Genjo Koan, is about how we as limited beings with limited viewpoints and limited capacities can possibly awaken to any kind of universal truth. How could we possibly know we've awakened to a universal truth? How would we verify that? We can't step outside who we are. We can't step outside being a human being. This is where later on we're talking about fish and birds that can never reach the end of the sky or the water. We can't escape from our limited selves. So doesn't that doom us to live out isolated experiences in our little perspective silos? And Genjo Koan is very much about trying to trying to explain how this can happen. My, you know, there's any of the descriptions that we try to apply to this, any words, any metaphors, whatever, are inadequate. But I thought one that I came up with, it's not very elegant, is that awakening, and this reflects some of what Dogen's saying here, that this does not destroy the person, does not destroy our lives. But it all is very, very radical. So imagine, you know, you're living your life and, you know, you have your responsibilities, you have your relationships, you have your role, you have your characteristics, all you know, you have your life going on. And, you know, some of it's great and, you know, you get excited and happy about that. Some of it's a bummer. And then, you know, sometimes things really suck and then you're quite upset. And then, like, one day you just notice a door and out of curiosity, you go through it. And you walk out of the theater into, like, the bright outdoors. Now you realize, like, your entire life was a play. Like, just imagine the, like, if you really believed the play, what, like, how that would blow your mind, right? That you're like, what? Wait, what? Like, suddenly everything is reoriented. Like, what is the meaning now? What? But, and this is where the metaphor kind of breaks down a little bit, is that you have the role in the play. You go back to the play. That is what it means to be alive, is to just be active in this. It doesn't have the same meaning we thought it did. But if you can imagine going about your life with the same attitude that you might play a role, right? That you might just, like, oh, this is the tragic act. I see. This is where I try to rise to the occasion. And there's, you know, oh, this is where I made a big mistake and then I have to apologize. But it would be with a completely different attitude than when we think this is it. This is the whole point. This is real. So that's my inelegant metaphor for awakening. And so in that sense, well, again, where it kind of breaks down is that, you know, the play, the drama is our daily life. And it's not unimportant. It's lovely.
Yeah. In the very first class, you were saying that the two were like two dimensions of a unified experience. And in that sense, the play isn't the play that you're going to walk out of the theater and be separate. So that, I have questions about that as a metaphor or analogy.
I think the theater analogy is wrong when it comes to that aspect, that sense that the play isn't real and somehow maybe outside is real or you can separate yourself from it. So that just kind of falls down. But what the theater metaphor does is point toward the experience of awakening to reality. So when you have only, you've really only been caught up in the relative dimension. And then you perceive in what sense, right here, right now, there's no separation from anything. We made all this up. Like that, the radical experience of that is like walking out the theater and recognizing, oh, that radical shift of your understanding of the situation. But you're not actually separate from the plane. You don't have the option of leaving it. And it's kind of demeaning. It makes it seem like life is, you know, kind of pathetic. But so kind of just set that aside. But that pointing more toward, because what tends to be not emphasized a lot in Soto Zen is how radical a perspective shift we're talking about. That it's huge, that it's life altering. Again, not that it necessarily happens on, you know, one night, but like, you know, but it is over time, at least completely life altering. And sometimes I don't think I, you know, when I get to think about this and I'm gonna lead a class on enlightenment and like well, what is it? What have I realized it? Am I awakened? You know, you can go down those rabbit holes, but the reality is that we're just we're just right here, right now. There's nothing I can hang on to from the past. No piece of knowledge, no insight. Which, like, it's not a fair portrayal of awakening if I'm carrying anything from the past or anything from the abstract into this moment to say, well, here, do. Like, that's how ungraspable it is. John.
Well, there was just several things that you said that I'd kind of related to. One of my favorite Buddhist sayings is, before enlightenment, chop wood, after enlightenment, chop wood. I like your play analogy. If you Google things like Leela, the divine play, whatever, it's not just Buddhism that perceives of life as like a divine play. Another analogy is like a veil. I mean, you basically see things totally different. And I think of, you know, karma is all the things that are compelling us forward. And we're pretty much feel like we're trapped in this life, and all of our past karma and everybody's karma is just compelling us forward. But I think when the veil lifts and you become enlightened, you understand everything. You're not separate. You're part of everything. And you realize how free you are. You see the possibilities, the boundlessness of any particular moment. And I think people from time to time gain that sort of insight a little bit at a time. Unfortunately, we tend to forget it. And I think that through a study like Zen, you can end up capturing those moments and figuring out how to live your life more deliberately and not forget those moments. I think all of us have the experience that we see somebody else is struggling with something, and we see that we see beyond their problems, but we can't explain it to them because they're just in a different mindset that they can't see them. And enlightenment is just the elimination of all those problems, really seeing the big picture, the whole veil drops.
Well, I worry a little about the elimination of all the problems, but like, because I don't think
it's the perception. I don't
even know that complete enlightenment is even a thing. Just, I mean, I'm not saying you say it is, but just, you know, the words, like, because we tend to, you know, like Dave was saying about an enlightened person. So there's a lot of potential pitfalls with, like, complete enlightenment would mean, you know, everything and, you know, whatever. But I do want to say that because I lost my train of thought before, and actually this is what I wanted to say was the incredibly radical perspective shift Now, some people have remarkable experiences, like, you know, they fall over laughing and just, you know, their whole world is different, but they have to integrate it. They have to, it takes a while. It actually is quite a disruptive thing to your brain and your life. But in terms of the gradual getting like wet in the mist, I am willing to bet, I can't prove it, that if you took my consciousness, not that such a thing exists, but whatever, somehow you could take my consciousness from 30 years ago before I started practice, and you could just, you know, like my during Zazen consciousness, and you could like plop it into my being right now, like, I think that being would experience, like, they'd just be, blow their mind. I think the sense of like smallness and feeling kind of trapped and feeling like just so self-absorbed, it was just, the world was just a big tragedy involving me. And like, you know, that and so now it's like that sense of self is still, it's still of course there, but it's, I always like to say, it's lighter. You know, it comes up, but it's not nearly as big a deal. It's really not as big a deal. So, you know, I think sudden or gradual, the perspective shift is very significant. And I'm sorry, Sylvia, it's 9:03. And there was somebody here who wanted to say something too, but I will wrap it up then. But you're always welcome to submit a Dharma question that I can then give another talk on. So we dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you for coming, everyone.
Thank you.